this week on capitalism, race, and democracy.
We found, among many bizarre payments, a $4.5 million payment from the U.S. Social Security Administration to the Kiev government. We found $4.5 billion worth of payments from the U.S. Agency for International Development to pay off Ukraine's sovereign debt, much of which is owned by the global investment firm BlackRock.
Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal testifies before the UN Security Council on U.S. weapons flows into Ukraine.
Here we are again, UPS just counting their billions, and they're asking for concessions. And so the members are not going to take it this time. And they're not waiting for their leaders to fight for them. They're taking the fight to the leaders and to the company.
340,000 UPS Teamsters may go on strike next month.
Because instead of protecting our students and making sure that Texas, the most diverse state in the country, where we have a majority African-American, Hispanic, and Asians over the last 10 years, they wanted to assault our black and brown communities by this nonsense of ending diversity, equity, and inclusion.
The Texas Board of Education replaces Houston's elected school board with a appointed superintendent and appointed managers, abruptly ending the terms of elected school board representatives by Houston's taxpayers. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm Cool Holt. The UN Security Council recently held a hearing to consider threats to international peace and security, specifically threats caused by massive weapons flows into the Ukraine war. The Russian Federation requested the meeting and asked journalist and Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal to speak about U.S. expenditures and weapon flows into Ukraine. This is his address.
Thank you. And I thank Alex Rubenstein and Wyatt Reed for helping me prepare this address. Wyatt Reed is a journalistic colleague of mine who in October 2022 happened to be in Donetsk when his hotel was shelled by the Ukrainian military with a apparently U.S.-made howitzer nearly killing him. He was 100 meters away. I'm also here with my friend, the civil rights activist Randy Credico, who is more recently in Donetsk and witnessed regular HIMARS attacks on civilian targets. I am here not only as a journalist who spent over 20 years writing books, producing documentaries, and writing articles about conflict and politics from several continents. I'm also here as an American taxpayer who's been dragooned into funding a proxy war that has become a threat to the regional and international stability at the expense of my countrymen and women. Just June 28th, as emergency crews worked to clean up yet another toxic train derailment in the United States, this time on the Montana River, further exposing our nation's chronically underfunded infrastructure and its threats to our health, the Pentagon announced plans to send an additional $500 million worth of military aid to Ukraine. The development came as Ukraine's army enters the third week of a vaunted counteroffensive that CNN describes as, quote, not meeting expectations, and which even Volodymyr Zelensky says is going slower than desired. As Ukraine's military failed to breach Russia's primary defense line, CNN reported on June 12th that Kiev had lost, quote, lost, 16 U.S.-made armored vehicles sent to the country. So what did the Pentagon do? It simply passed that bill down to average U.S. taxpayers like myself, charging us another $325 million to replace Ukraine's squandered military stock. There was zero effort to consult the U.S. public's position on the matter, and the vast majority of Americans likely did not even know the exchange took place. This policy that I'm describing to you, which sees Washington prioritize unrestrained funding for a proxy war with a nuclear power in a foreign land, while our domestic infrastructure falls apart before our eyes, exposes a disturbing dynamic at the heart of the Ukraine conflict. An international Ponzi scheme that enables Western elites to seize hard-earned wealth from the hands of average U.S. citizens and funnel it into the coffers of a foreign government that even Transparency International ranks as consistently one of the most corrupt in Europe. The U.S. government has yet to conduct an official audit of its funding for Ukraine. The American public has no idea where their tax dollars are going. And that's why this week, we at the Gray Zone published an independent audit of U.S. tax dollar allocation to Ukraine throughout the fiscal years 2022 and 23. Our investigation was led by Heather Kaiser, a former military intelligence officer who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. We found, among many bizarre payments, a $4.5 million payment from the U.S. Social Security Administration to the Kiev government. We found $4.5 billion worth of payments from the U.S. Agency for International Development to pay off Ukraine's sovereign debt, much of which is owned by the global investment firm BlackRock. That amounts to $30 taken from every U.S. citizen at a time when 4 in 10 Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency. We found tax dollars earmarked for Ukraine, padding the budgets of a television station in Toronto, a pro-NATO think tank in Poland, and believe it or not, even rural farmers in Kenya. We found tens of millions to private equity firms, including one in the Republic of Georgia, as well as $1 million payment to a single private entrepreneur in Kiev. Our audit also revealed the Pentagon's $4.5 million contract with a company called Atlantic Diving Supply to provide Ukraine with unspecified explosives equipment. This is a notoriously corrupt company that none other than Tom Tillis, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, previously lambasted for its, quote, history of fraud. It once again, Congress has failed to ensure these shady payments and massive arms deals are properly tracked. In fact, much of the military and humanitarian aid shipped to Ukraine has simply vanished. Last year, CBS News quoted the director of a pro-Zelensky nonprofit in Ukraine who reported that only 30% of aid was reaching the front lines. The embezzlement of funds and supplies is at least as troubling as the potential consequences of the illicit transfer and sales of military-grade weapons. Last June, the head of Interpol warned that the massive transfers of arms into Ukraine means, quote, we can expect an influx of weapons in Europe and beyond, and that criminals are now, as we speak, focusing on them. This May, a group of anti-Kremlin Russian exiles outfitted with gear supplied by the Ukrainian government was hailed by Western politicians for carrying out terrorist attacks in Russian territory using American-made Humvees. Although the group, the so-called Russian Volunteer Corps, is led by a man who calls himself the, quote, White King, and includes numerous open admirers of Adolf Hitler, described as neo-Nazis in U.S. mainstream media, the Western weaponization of this militia against Russian forces and Russian civilians has not prompted any outcry from Congress. And while the Biden administration has promised that it's keeping tabs on the weapons sent, a State Department cable leaked last December conceded that, quote, kinetic activity and active combat between Ukrainian and Russian forces create an environment in which standard verification measures are sometimes impracticable or impossible. The Biden administration not only knows that it cannot track the weapons it's shipping to Ukraine, it knows that it is escalating a proxy war against the world's largest nuclear power and daring it to respond in kind. We know this because back in 2014, and this timeline is so important, that's when NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the war started following a U.S.-backed coup d'etat. President Barack Obama rejected demands from Kiev to send lethal offensive weaponry because, as the Wall Street Journal put it, he had a, quote, long-standing concern that arming Ukraine would provoke Moscow into further escalation that would drag Washington into a proxy war. When Donald Trump entered office in 2017, he attempted to hold the line on Barack Obama's policy, but was soon branded a Russian puppet by the Beltway Press Corps and the Democratic Party for refusing to send Raytheon's Javelin missiles to the Ukrainian military. His reluctance to send the Javelins became a central theme of his impeachment, and he predictably relented. As U.S.-made offensive weaponry began to reach the front lines of the Donbass, the collective West exploited the Minsk Accords to, quote, give Ukraine time to arm up, as the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel put it. In January 2022, the U.S. announced a $200 million arms package to Ukraine. Follow the timeline. By the 18th of February, observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe reported a doubling in ceasefire violations, with OSCE maps showing the overwhelming majority of targeted sites on the side of pro-Russian separatists in Donetsk and Lugansk. 5 days later, Russia invaded Ukraine. And since then, the U.S. and its allies have been scurrying up the escalation ladder at every opportunity. Quote, things we couldn't give in January because it was escalatory were given in February, a former State Department official complained after meeting with Ukrainian counterparts. And things we couldn't give in February, we can in April. That has been the distinct pattern, starting with, for crying out loud, stingers, referring to shoulder-mounted rockets. Joe Biden himself said in March 2022, the idea that we're going to send in offensive equipment and have planes and tanks, don't kid yourself. No matter what you all say, that's called World War III. Just over a year later, Biden changed his tune, backing a plan to provide F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, and after pressuring Germany to send in the tanks he once feared would provoke World War III. It would only take 2 months from the time Ukraine received Lockheed-made HIMARS systems for the Ukrainian military to begin targeting critical infrastructure, using them to strike the Antonovsky Bridge over the Dnipro River, and again, 2 months later, in a test strike on the Kakhovka Dam to see if the Dnipro's water could be raised enough to stymie Russian crossings, as the Washington Post reported. 3 weeks ago, the Kakhovka Dam was destroyed, triggering a major environmental catastrophe that caused mass flooding and contamination of the local water supply. Ukraine, of course, blames Russia for this attack, but has produced no evidence. Around this time, Ukraine also baselessly accused Russia of planning a provocation at the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. This triggered a resolution by Senators Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal, no relation to me, calling for NATO to intervene directly in Ukraine and attack Russia if such an incident occurred. The move by Blumenthal and Graham established a de facto red line for initiating U.S. military action, much like the one set down in Syria, which, as a former U.S. diplomat commented to journalist Charles Glass, was an open invitation to a false flag. Will we see another Duma deception, but this time in Zaporizhia? This time with nuclear consequences? Why are we doing this? Why are we tempting nuclear annihilation by flooding Ukraine with advanced weapons and sabotaging negotiations at every turn? We've been told by people like Senator Dick Durbin that Ukraine is literally in a battle for freedom and democracy itself. And therefore, anyone who opposes military aid to Ukraine opposes the very defense of democracy, according to this logic. So where's the democracy in Vladimir Zelensky's decision to ban opposition parties, to criminalize the media outlets of his legitimate political opponents, to jail his top political rival and his deputies, to raid Orthodox churches and jail clergymen? Where is the democracy in the Ukrainian government's imprisonment of Gonzalo Lira, an American citizen, simply for challenging the official narrative of Ukraine's war? And where is the democracy in Zelensky's recent decision to suspend elections in 2024 on the grounds that martial law has been declared? The answer is that Ukrainian democracy is harder to find these days than that country's commander-in-chief, Valery Zaluzhny. Senator Lindsey Graham has offered a much more grim and more on-the-mark rationale for supplying Ukraine with billions in weapons. As the senator boasted during a recent visit with Zelensky in Kiev, the Russians are dying. It's the best money we've ever spent. I repeat, the Russians are dying. It's the best money we've ever spent. And Graham has also said that Americans are ready to fight this war down to the last Ukrainian. While official casualty numbers are strictly classified, we must worry that Ukraine is well on its way to fulfilling the senator's ghoulish fantasies. As a Ukrainian soldier complained this month to Vice News, we don't know what Zelensky's plans are, but, quote, it looks like the extermination of its own population, like of the combat-ready and working-age population. That's it. Indeed, military cemeteries in Ukraine are expanding almost as rapidly as the Northern Virginia McMansions and beachfront estates of executives from Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and assorted beltway contractors, benefiting from the second highest level of military spending since World War II. These are the real winners of the Ukraine proxy war, not average Ukrainians or Americans or Russians. The winners, or Europeans for that matter, the winners are people like Secretary of State Tony Blinken, who spent his time between the Obama and Biden administrations launching a consulting firm called West Exec Advisors, which secured lucrative government contracts for intelligence firms and the arms industry. Blinken's former partners at WestExec include Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines, CIA Deputy Director David Cohen, former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, and almost a dozen current and former members of Biden's national security team. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, for his part, is a former and possibly future member of board member of Raytheon, and an ex-partner of Pine Island Capital Investment, which collaborates with WestExec and which Blinken himself has advised. Meanwhile, the current U.S. ambassador to this body, the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, is listed as a senior counsel at the Albright-Stonebridge Group, a self-described commercial diplomacy firm that also finesses government contracts for the intelligence and arms sector, and which was founded by Madeleine Albright, infamously known for her comments that the deaths by sanctions of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth it. So while military-age Ukrainian men are ripped off the streets by military police and sent to the front lines, the financially and politically connected architects of this proxy war are planning to walk through the revolving door to reap unimaginable profits once their time in the Biden administration is over. For them, a negotiated settlement to this territorial dispute means an end to the cash cow of close to $150 billion in U.S. aid to Ukraine. So in closing, when the United States, my country, a permanent member of this council, has fallen under the control of a bipartisan regime which seeks to perpetuate a proxy war for as long as it takes, in the words of Joe Biden, which considers diplomacy synonymous with unilateral coercive measures to, quote, turn the ruble to rubble, as Biden pledged to do, whose leadership subverts negotiations in order to pursue profit while refusing to properly inform its own citizens what they're paying for, and pushes the sons and brothers of its supposed Ukrainian partners out onto a killing field in order to bludgeon a geopolitical rival? When both Zelensky and members of U.S. Congress are calling for preemptive strikes on Russia, which have nothing to do with Article 51 of the UN Charter, this Council must take action to enforce that charter. That charter is clear that the Security Council must use its authority to guarantee a pacific settlement of dispute, particularly when it threatens international security. That should not only apply to Russia and Ukraine. This Council has an obligation to strictly monitor and restrain the U.S. and the illegal military formation known as NATO. Thank you.
That was journalist and Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal addressing the UN Security Council. Classic by Jimi Hendrix, the U.S. National Anthem, Woodstock, 1969. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On August 1st, 34,000 Teamsters working for United Parcel may go on strike, and according to Philadelphia IBT 623, Executive Officer Richard Booker, they are still not being told what the union is demanding from the company. Hooker spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zelter.
We have 33 days left before the contract expires, and we are really at a crossroads. The company, when their first economic counterproposal, really showed how they really feel about our members. And of course, once the members found out about their proposal, now they're even more angry, more furious. They want the strike now. And I think if UPS does not come to the table with a sense of urgency, then come August 1st, then they're going to feel that frustration. They're going to experience all the things that those members, our members, have went through for the last 5 years. COVID really put our members, really pushed them to the edge and over the edge. UPS made so much money during the COVID pandemic, as well as Amazon, the Walmarts, the Targets, anybody in that industry, because everybody was ordering online and somebody had to deliver it. Who delivered it? It was the worker, the UPS worker, right? And now here we are again, UPS just counting their billions and they're asking for concessions. And so the members are not going to take it this time. We're more organized. I think a lot of our low wage workers, part-time workers, are uniting in a way that we have never seen before. And I've been here in this company for 24 years, and I've never seen the part-timers this engaged, this organized, and they're not waiting for their leaders to fight for them. They're taking the fight to the leaders and to the company. So this is very inspiring to see. And if UPS is not careful, they're going to put themselves in a box where they can't get out of. Those part-time workers make up 65-70% of their workforce. If they don't do the right thing by those workers, nobody can outvote them. Nobody can do anything. So if this contract does not meet their demands, then August 1st, we're going to be on the side of the road.
And the issue of non-disclosure agreements, the secrecy, what is the company actually offered? What is their last offer?
We don't know. And that's the problem for both sides, the union side and the company side. Our members want to know what is the union proposing for as wages and health care and pensions and sick time. It's one thing to have something leaked from the company, but it's a whole nother thing if we don't see what our side is offering. Because what we don't want is to be, well, okay, the company's lowball, and then we turn around and then we have a proposal from the union and it doesn't meet our standards. And then, of course, we understand what the company is trying to do, but what is our side trying to do? We need to know that, because 33 days left, we need to have a conversation with our members. We need to be able to address their concerns. We need to be able to answer their questions. And right now we can't, because we don't have that information. And so I'm hoping sometime here in the near future, hopefully the next day or two, especially when we're coming down to the ninth inning, you'll get to see what our side is proposing, because those non-disclosure agreements, I really put a hamper on the transparency. Full transparency is something that we was promised, and we have not gotten up to this point. We need to see what our side is proposing to counter what the company is proposing. We need to see it.
Well, the same thing happened in the ILWU, where they had this non-disclosure agreement. You can't talk about what's going on. So the members had to hear about sections of their contract from the Wall Street Journal. This is in the ILWU, that you have to go to the Wall Street Journal to find out what your contract is. It sounds like business unionism, corporate unionism. I mean, the idea of this non-disclosure agreement, who the hell wants that but corporations? Isn't that what they oppose on settlements and everything else?
Right, exactly. And so for us to be having these, and I get it, you don't want certain information out there. You don't want to post it on social media, but you don't want to limit the union's ability to communicate effectively to its membership, because that's how rumors start. That's how division starts. That's how, you know, contention starts to fight, come in into the negotiation process. And you don't want that. You want to be united as possible against every employer. So if I don't know what my negotiators are negotiating for me, and I got to hear from the Wall Street Journal, I got to find out about it on social media, or I'm getting bits and pieces of it, then they can twist it however they want to whatever their agenda is. But if I know what is being proposed, nobody can create a rumor. Nobody can twist it. We're more unified, because now I know what the company is going to, you know, say, in retrospect to my union side. But if we don't know that, it puts us at a disadvantage. And right now, man, we don't need to be at a disadvantage, because 33 days left. This thing is coming down to the end, and members need to know what is being negotiated on their behalf. And I get we have 55 TAs so far, but again, until we are able to see all those TAs and actually look at the language, because UPS, they thrive on ambiguity. If there's gray areas, they can exploit that. And so we need to make sure that there is no gray areas that harms our members. But in order to get that, we got to get those. We got to see what the proposals are.
Democracy, membership control. Why don't you talk about the difference between this campaign and what you experienced with the Kerry campaign when you did have a national strike?
Well, I was still in high school when Kerry was in office. But I can tell you from the Hoffa years that there was little to no information at all. I can tell you in 2018, it was at the last minute. Even our local officers actually told us without giving us any information, saying, if you don't vote yes the first time, then UPS is not going to contribute the full amount of money into your pension. And we were like, well, when did this happen? What's the other parts of the contract? So we're sitting in a meeting with no information. We were just in the dark. And, you know, and this under this administration with O'Brien, the information has been better, but there has still been a total brownout, but there has been some situations where the members just actually need to know more about what's going on, especially this late in the game. Like if you ask a member, just a member who comes to meetings and stuff like that, hey, what is the union proposing for your wages? He wouldn't be able to tell you. I can't tell you. What is the union proposing in pension benefits?
They don't even put out what they're demanding, what their demands are, like $25 an hour. They're not even putting that out?
No, they're just saying we're demanding higher wages.
What is that?
Exactly. And so when our members ask us, for an example, at our last union meeting, had somebody come up to the mic, one of the members, hey, what are we asking for in wages? What's the dollar amount? I had to tell that member, we don't know. Well, what do you mean you don't know? You're the principal officer. Why don't you know what we are asking for in wages? I don't know. Well, again, why don't you know?
Why is O'Brien keeping out a secret from the members?
I don't know. And this is the part that shocks me, because 5 years ago, Brother O'Brien was the president of Joint Council 10. And I remember this like it was yesterday. And I was actually very impressed with what he was doing. So I think every day or every couple of days, what Joint Council 10 would do was they would put out the proposals from the company and the union, and it would tell you on this date, they agreed to this. The company said yes to this. They said no to that. We counted with this. And it was a detailed description of what the company and union was doing, the date, the time. I was like, okay, this is good. He even had a Facebook live stream where people could actually call in and ask questions about the contract. One of my members from 623 actually called in and talked about what our local leaders were doing. And it was refreshing to see that a leader would actually put all of it out there. There was no ambiguity. Everything was transparent. We knew where his members knew what was going on. And I thought, based on what he did in 2018, when it comes to that kind of transparency and that level of transparency, that we were going to get that during this negotiations, now that he's the general president. I thought that we were going to get that type of transparency.
Seems like these employers, these corporations are forcing people against the wall. I covered the writers' strike, and the writers have said it's an existential crisis because they want to destroy them as an industry, so they're all gig workers. It seems like the Democrats have no solution as the Republicans, as far as AI is concerned. There needs to be a political alternative for working people, that you can have a program that if you introduce technology, it's going to benefit workers. The longshoremen, the same thing. They want to automate the ports, get rid of all the longshoremen.
Now, you know that's crazy. You know that's crazy. Come on. But again, this is what the billionaires, the capitalist system, this is what they want. Get rid of the workers, get more profits. And like you said, the Democrats, Republicans, they're both parties serve the same master. And it's not the workers. They don't serve us at all. They care about the rich and powerful. They keep them in office, donate to their campaigns hundreds of thousands of dollars. And while we're struggling to make it, they're going to continue to do what they need to do for their constituents and the people that, you know, donate to their campaigns. And if we don't have a workers' party or somebody who's actually for us, then we're going to be fighting this war all of the time, and we're not going to win unless we get a champion or a group of people or a party, political party, who is for labor, by labor, endorsed by labor, and just labor, labor, labor. But until then, we're going to be in trouble with either party, either party.
That was Philadelphia Teamsters Local 623 Executive Officer Richard Hooker speaking with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer. Want to talk about it? Colonize mine. Upload revolution principle. We see a rock on the shore and say it's always been there. Download, no responsibility. Do what you want, nobody cares. Upload the master race idea. Genetically disposed to rule the world. Down low, a future full of isolated, full of isolated boys and girls. Upload a two-party system. The lesser of two dangers, illusion of choice. Down low, a veiled form of fascism. Nothing really ever changed. You never had a voice. Music by Prince, Colonize Mind. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On June 8, 2023, in Houston, Texas, a coalition of organizations held a news conference and rally prior to the first meeting of the unelected Houston Independent School Board appointed by the state of Texas. The Texas Education Agency first attempted to seize control of the Houston Independent School District in 2019. After a long legal battle, the Texas Supreme Court ruled in January 2023 that state-appointed managers could replace elected school board members in the largest school district in Texas. The justices overruled the appellate court's decision that had barred the Texas Education Agency from a takeover of a mostly Black and Latino school district in Houston. Here's State Representative Ron Reynolds and others speaking out at a rally in front of the district office.
And their kids to private schools. That is what. Instead of having a record number of people dying in Texas over the last decade and leading this country in mass shootings, we just had Uvalde, where we had to bury 21 people, including 19 students and two teachers, and then most recently, Allen. They didn't do a damn thing to help common sense gun reforms and keep our kids safe at schools. They deserve an F. Because instead of protecting our students and making sure that Texas, the most diverse state in the country, where we have a majority African-American, Hispanic, and Asians over the last 10 years, they wanted to assault our Black and brown communities by this nonsense of ending diversity, equity, and inclusion. They deserve an F. Because instead of protecting our students, all students, including our LGBTQ plus students, they assaulted and attacked our LGBTQ students. And instead of making sure that our children have access to books, they wanted to ban books. So that is why we have to make sure that we make our voices heard. Let's continue to speak truth to power. Let's let TA and Governor Abbott and TA Commissioner Mike Marath know that not a day will go by when we would not bring and demand accountability, not on our watch. When we fight, we win. When we fight, we win. When we fight, we win. So let's stand up for students. Let's stand up for teachers. Let's stand up for bus drivers. Let's stand up for custodians. Let's stand up to make sure that those in black and brown and marginalized communities have a voice that is, does, Bishop, what it says in Proverbs 31:8-9. And it says, speak out for the one who could not speak. Speak up for the rights of those who are doomed. Speak up, judge fairly, and defend the rights of oppressed and needy people. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm fired up, and I'm going to continue fighting. Let's let Governor Abbott add that to the special session, giving our teachers a pay raise. Thank you.
Before we invite our final speaker up today, I just want to first thank you for being here. Again, my name is Ani Blair, and I'm with the ACLU of Texas. I also want to remind you why we're here. So after this is over, those who want to are invited to walk inside to bear witness to the sham meeting that's taking place. Now I'd like to invite a person who has been a leader in this movement, who has been consistently ensuring that we convene, that we are speaking with one voice, that we are breaking down barriers between communities, races, incomes, backgrounds, neighborhoods, to stand up against the forces that are trying to take over our elected officials, Bishop Dixon.
Come on, Bishop. Today is definitely a sad day in Houston, Texas. The day when we witnessed the most egregious, atrocious, immoral act against children than we have ever witnessed before. Today is a day when we witnessed a harsh, cold, callous reaction to the progress of democracy. This nation is a nation built on a principle, one person, one vote. If we overlaid what's happening today in Houston to the Boston Tea Party, we would recognize the similarities that this means taxation without representation. It needs to be stated very clearly. There's a lot of issues here, but at the bottom of it, it really boils down to taxation without representation. And the leaders who are responsible for this hostile takeover need to be held accountable and asked the question, why is it in 2023 that you are supporting policies that take us back to taxation without representation?
Come on, Bishop. Take it down.
The school buildings, in fact, the property we stand on today, is paid for by the taxes of hardworking people who are in this assembly and around this community. The building is owned by the taxpayers.
Come on, man.
But today, taxpayers have no voice at what takes place in their building.
Come on, Bishop.
Every school building in HISD has been bought and paid for by the taxpayers in this community. Yet, no taxpayer has a voice as to say what happens with curriculum, what happens with programming, what happens with facilities, what happens with personnel. Taxpayers are hushed. We need to ask the question, why are government officials, as Rep. Reynolds just said, taking the action to take us back to what we protested?
Oh my God.
This nation was founded on protest.
That's right. Come on, man.
The protest was about taxation without representation.
That's right. All right.
And so today we are
come on, man.
The true American patriots. This is what America at her birth looked like. And the ones who are supporting these unconstitutional policies look like the ones we protested against. So if the principle worked, a protest against taxation without representation, if it worked then, why is it today that we don't see the same faces who used to advocate that? It's because they are not about democracy, they're about autocracy. It really boils down to people who want to remain in power at all costs.
Come on, come on.
There is no logical reason why you shut down a district that's earned a B+ in 1 year during COVID. There's no explanation why you shut down a district that has a AAA bond rating. So I close with this. This cannot be our final gathering.
That's right.
About the money.
This is all about money.
Yes.
It's all about power.
Power.
And it's all about, get this now, taking the power from people who have earned the right to have it through process, through the process of voting. And listen, a trustee, the root word of trustee is trust.
That's right.
So those who did not support the people can't be trusted. Listen, we've seen a few board members stand with us. We need to question the absence of the others. They can't be trusted. And everyone who runs for any office, whether it's city council, state representative, senator, mayor, ask them the question, where were you when it was time to save HISD? In every screening, ask the question, where do you stand on the HISD takeover? Because if they would not stand up against the powers that took over HISD, they will not stand up for you. Taxation without representation, that's what this is all about, and we will not ever go away.
Those were the voices of Houstonians and State Representative Ron Reynolds, who spoke out at a rally on June 8th against the Republican takeover of the largest school district in Texas. The Houston Independent School District had one underperforming school last year out of a total of 226 schools. Recently, a newly appointed board approved a $2.2 billion budget that included cuts in the central office and contractor services. The number of jobs that are expected to be cut was not announced. Meanwhile, Mayor Sylvester Turner posted online that the TEA takeover of the Houston Independent School District could last at least 7 years.
This is an excerpt from a poem called Why Is We Americans? But reality is an excerpt on television. Why is we Americans? Why is we Americans? Boo-dee-da, 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 boo-dee-boo-dee-boo-boo. What I want is me, for real. I want me and myself, and what that is what I be and what I see and feel, and who is me and the what it is and who it is and when it me is what it be. I'm going to be here if I want, like I said, self-determination. But I ain't come from a foolish tribe. We wants the mule, the land. You can make it 300 years of blue chip stock in the entire operation. We want to be paid in a central bank, the average worker, farmer wage for all those years we gave it free. Plus, we want damages for all the killings and the fraud, the lynchings, the missing justice, the lies and frame-ups, the unwarranted jailings, the tar and featherings, the character and race assassinations, historical slander, ugly caricatures. For every Sambo, step and fetch it flick, we want to be paid. For every hurtful thing you did or said, for all the land you took, for all the rapes, all the rosewoods and black Wall Street you destroyed, all the miseducation, jobs lost, segregated shacks we lived in, the disease that ate and killed us, for all the mad police that drilled us, for all the music and dances you stole, the styles, the language, the hip clothes you copped, the careers you stopped. All these are suits. Specific litigation as represent we, be like we, for reparations for damages paid to the Afro-American nation. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da. We want education for all of us and anyone else in the black pelt hurt by slavery, for all the native peoples, even them poor white people you show all the time is funny, all them Abners and Daisy Mays, them Beverly Hillbillies who never got to know Beverly Hills, who never got to Harvard on their grandfather's wills. We want reparations for them, right on, for the Mexicans whose land you stole, for all of North Mexico, you call it Texas, Arizona, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all that, all that, all that, all that. Be-dee-da, doo-doo. Ba 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 doo dee doo. All that you got to give up. Autonomy and reparations to the Chicanos and the Native Americans whose soul you ripped out with their land. Give self-determination, regional autonomy. That's what my we is asking, and they gonna do the same when they demand it like us again in their own exploited name. Yeah, the education, that's right. 200 years. We want a central stash, a central bank with democratically elected trustees and a board elected by us all to map out from the referendum we set up what we want to spend it on to build that Malcolm sense self-determination as self-reliance and self-respect and self-defense, the will of what the good Dr. Du Bois beat on, true self-consciousness, simply the psychology of freedom. Boo-dee-da, boo-dee-da, pee-dee-da, boo-dee-da, that ba-ba-ba, boo-dee-boo-dee-boo.
The great Amiri Baraka, Why Is We Americans? This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Frederick Douglass delivered a speech on July 5, 1852, to a group of abolitionists, reminding them that for enslaved and formerly enslaved Africans, the Declaration of Independence represented the unfulfilled promise of liberty to all. Here is Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from the speech at a program organized by the U.S. National Archives and Record.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, it is a day that reveals to him more than any other day of the year the gross conduct and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. You know what is a swine drover? I'll show you a man drover. They inhabit all of our southern states. They perambulate the country and crowd the highways of the nation in droves of human stock. Armed with pistol, whip, and bowie knife, driving 100 men, women, and children, these wretched souls are to be sold singly or in lots to suit purchasers. They are food for the cotton field and the deadly sugar mill. March the sad procession as they move along, and the savage wretch who drives them. See the old man with locks thin and gray. See the young woman whose shoulders are bare to the scorching sun. Her briny tears falls on the brow of the babe in her arms. See, too, the young girl of 13, weeping as she thinks of her mother from whom she's been torn. Mark the sad procession. Heat and sorrow nearly consumes their strength. Suddenly you hear a quick snap, like the discharge of a rifle. The fetters clank, the chains rattle, Your ears are saluted with a scream that seems to have torn its way into the center of your soul. The crack you heard was the sound of a whip. The scream you heard was the mother with the babe in her arms. Her strength had faltered under the weight of the chains and the child, and the gash in her shoulder tells her to move on. Follow the procession to New Orleans. Attend an auction there. See men examined like horses. See the frames of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. Tell me, citizens, where under the sun can you witness such a spectacle more fiendish and shocking? Yet this is but a glimpse of the American slave system as it exists in the ruling part of the United States. But it is just in this moment when I hear someone in my audience say, it is just at this time that you and your fellow abolitionists failed to make a favorable impression upon the public mind. If you would argue more and denounce less, if you would persuade more and rebuke less, your cause might be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there's nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? Am I to argue the point that the slave is a man? The point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. Slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of the laws of their government. They acknowledge it when they punish a slave for disobedience. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, may subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of those same crimes, if committed by a white man, may subject him to like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? Southern statute books are filled with enactments teaching the slave under severe fines and penalties how to read and to write. When you can point to any such laws as it relates to the beast of the field, then I will consent to argue the manhood of the slave. Americans, your Republican politics, as well as your Republican religion, is fragrantly inconsistent. You boast of your love for liberty, your high civilization, your pure Christianity, while all the while the whole political power of the nation conspires to hold in bondage 3 million of its countrymen. You celebrate fugitives from abroad. You honor them with banquets. You toast them. You salute them. You bless them. But of your own fugitives at home, you advertise. You hunt, arrest, shoot, and kill. You mourn fallen Hungary. You make her wrongs the subject of your poets, your orators, and your statesmen. But of the 10,000 wrongs committed against the American slave, you enforce the strictest silence and would deem him an enemy of the nation that would make their subject public discourse. You say that all men are created of one blood and that all men everywhere should love one another, yet you notoriously hate those whose skin is not colored like your own. You proclaim before the world, and before the world proclaim, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have been endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Yet, you hold in bondage a seventh part of the inhabitants of your country. Friends, the existence of slavery in this country brands your republicanism a sham, your humanity a base pretense, your Christianity a lie. It destroys your moral power abroad. It corrupts your politicians at home. It saps the very foundation of religion. It makes your name a hissing and a byword to a mocking earth.
That was Phil Darius Wallace reading excerpts from Frederick Douglass' speech delivered on July 5, 1852, What to the Negro is the 4th of July, to a group of abolitionists in Rochester, New York. Visit the U.S. National Archives and Records to learn more. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. What I think the political correctness debate is really about is the power to be able to define. The definers want the power to name, and the defined are now taking that power away from them. Toni Morrison.